When you hear the name Houdini, you might think of a performer of worldwide fame in a time when it was a lot harder to become well-known across the world. You may not know that some of his formative years before he actually was known as Harry Houdini were spent here in Wisconsin. Adam Begley is the author of Updike and the Great Nadar. He was a Guggenheim Fellow, a fellow at the Leon Levy Center for Biography, and for many years was the book's editor of the New York Observer. His most recent book is Houdini, the Elusive American, which is part of the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. He lives in England and joins us from there. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's start in the early years of Harry Houdini. And there's a couple discrepancies. He was born in Hungary. He lived a lot of his early life in Appleton. He said he was born in Appleton, though. Can you talk some of the early days about of Eric Weiss, who later became Harry Houdini?
Yeah, Harry Houdini was born in Budapest in 1874 and moved to the United States when he was 4 years old. And the family settled in Appleton, Wisconsin. And he spent six happy years there wanted, like many immigrants at that time, to become American. And so in later life, he simply asserted that he had been born in Appleton, which was, of course, a lie, but it was one that worked for him.
I imagine, Adam, it's got to be a challenge to be a biographer of Harry Houdini, because in his life, if there was a choice between, you know, the facts and the truth on one hand and the story he wanted to tell and the way he wanted to promote himself on the other, he always went with the best self-promotion possible. Can you talk about that a little?
He was a master publicist for himself, and he never let the facts get in the way. When he was starting to get famous, he went back to Appleton and did performances there and spoke to the local newspapers and told them that he'd been all over the world performing his act. Of course, at that point, he had never left the United States. He just didn't have a particularly cozy relationship with the truth.
Now, he moved from Appleton to Milwaukee after his father lost his job as a rabbi in Appleton. What was life like in Milwaukee for Harry, again, still Eric at that point?
His father, Samuel Mayer Weiss, lost his job as a rabbi in Appleton because he was really sort of an old-fashioned, old-world European rabbi, and the people of Appleton wanted something a little racier and more modern. So the Weiss family, and there were six children at this point, moved to Milwaukee, where there was very hard times indeed, and they were often just one step away from eviction and had to apply for charity, free deliveries of coal and meat from the Jewish Relief Society. It was a dark time in his life, but he worked for the Milwaukee Journal as a newsboy, and he shined shoes, and he became interested in circuses and magic tricks.
And he, I gather, at the tender age of 9, he first started trying to do his own contortion and trapeze tricks.
Yes, he was precocious and always interested in performing. I think the life in the Weiss family, I mean, we don't know very much about this period of his life, but we know that in 1886, when he was 12, he ran away from home. He left Milwaukee and got about as far as, I think, Hannibal, Missouri, before heading back in the direction of Wisconsin. And he spent some time in Delavan, Wisconsin, which is not far from Milwaukee, where he was taken in by a kindly couple. And he went by the name at the time, Harry White, which is, of course, the English version of Eric Weiss.
Talking to Adam Begley about his new book, Houdini, the Elusive American. We're talking a little bit about Harry Houdini's background, his early days in Wisconsin. Now, Adam, moving into Harry Houdini's career, One of the things that strikes me is I guess the physicality. He was obsessed with physical fitness, learning tricks like at a so-called freak show where he learned how to use his toes to pick things up from a man without arms. If we look at Harry Houdini's tricks, there were tricks that you could teach me and I could try to do them and I could die because I wouldn't have the physical skills. Can you just talk about the physical side of Harry Houdini?
Yes, Harry was a fitness freak. He was quite a good athlete. He was very strong, very supple, very determined to learn the tricks of the trade, which for him was basically dime store museums and circuses and sideshows. And he met a lot of freaks, as they were called at the time, and learned a great deal from them. And what you mentioned there about learning to use his toes was extremely important. He could manipulate keys with his toes with a tremendous amount of dexterity to unlock handcuffs, and among other things. But later in life, he developed some tricks that were really quite extraordinary. One called the Chinese water torture cell involved Harry being lowered by his ankles into a container that was sort of like the size and shape of a phone booth that was filled with water, and then he would be clamped in there upside down underwater, and he would then wriggle his way out. This involved some trick technology, but if you're upside down in a tiny phone booth sized container full of water, you better be pretty supple and pretty quick and pretty strong, or you are going to drown.
He and his brother at one point and his wife at another point, they toured the country doing all manner of performance. There was some comedy, some magic, of course, some spiritualism and seances, which I think we'll talk about a little later. How mm-hmm. did Harry Houdini end up with Escape Artist as his most famous, his most impressive credential?
There are two strands to that, really. One is that early on he used handcuffs in his escapes, and he wasn't the only one to do it, but he did it very well. And he would, where other people, for example, would bind their wrists with rope and manage to break out of it, he would use not only handcuffs but leg irons and all kinds of chains draped around his body, and he would get out of those. The other thing he did was to publicize himself. He would go to police departments and offer to be put in jail, often stripped naked, and they would put his clothes in a different cell and lock them away, and about 15 minutes later, he would be back fully clothed and sometimes even having broken into other cells and moved the prisoners around. He did this not to, in front of an audience, but to garner publicity. He would get journalists. He would tip off journalists that he was going to go to the jail and do these things, and they would write it up, and he would get publicity for his show in town the next night or the next week.
He toured the country again with his wife for a long time, making not a lot of money, just kind of doing these small shows. There was a turning point, I think it was in the Twin Cities, where he hit the big time. Can you talk about that moment?
Yes. That happened in 1899, and he'd started performing in 1891. And for 5 years, he'd been performing with his wife as the Great Houdinis. And really, they were scraping a living. They so often didn't have enough to eat. They would have to perform maybe five or six times a day. The audiences were bored. The places were really low rent. It wasn't an attractive lifestyle. But they persevered, and he kept at it. And he and his wife were real troopers and real performers. And then one day in 1899, a guy named Martin Beck, who was an impresario with a vaudeville circuit, saw his act and really liked the handcuff escape and offered him a contract. And this completely changed his life. It more or less doubled his pay instantly and gave him security and gave him a proper audience and a little bit of dignity, because vaudeville was a step up in the world from the kind of dime show and circus venues that he had been playing before. And it really changed his life. He in fact wrote a note on the telegram he got from Martin Beck that said, "This is the moment my life changed."
We continue our conversation now with author Adam Begley about his newest book, Houdini, the Elusive American. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the legendary escape artist Harry Houdini. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hello.
Hi, I think we've all watched this very old black and white biography of Harry Houdini. It was entertaining. In fact, it featured the famous water trick that your biographer talked about. But my question is, in the movie, it portrays him as being supposedly obsessed with both the afterlife and contacting his deceased mother. I'm interested in knowing if this is myth or if it's fact, and to what extent this spiritualism or spiritual issue was of importance to him, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. You write a lot about Harry Houdini and seances, fake and otherwise. Could you talk about that a little bit, Adam?
Yes. To answer the question, the first question, I think you're referring to the movie Houdini starring Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh that came out in 1953. And indeed, the Chinese water torture cell does feature there. And yes, Houdini in that is obsessed with the afterlife and with his, especially contacting his dead mother. Houdini was absolutely obsessed with his mother. And when she died in 1913, it was a terrible blow for him. And he tried very hard to get in touch with her through mediums at spiritualist seances without any luck. And he very quickly saw through the performances that these mediums would give at the seances, because he himself had done a little work in that sideline before deciding that it was a, as he called it, a bad effect, something he shouldn't be doing, that because he felt that it made light of the seriousness of mourning the departed. And that it was essentially about tricking people in a bad way, as opposed to the more benign tricking people involved in magic tricks.
Jim, thanks a lot for that. Oh, sorry, go on.
No. I would think we should at some point talk about Houdini's career as an anti-spiritualist.
Somebody. Right. That's what I wanted to ask about next. He knew how the tricks worked, and he set about exposing them, right?
That's correct. It's starting in the early 1920s, when he was at this point really quite a famous man and famous all over the world, especially in Europe and in the United States. He started taking on spiritualism in a concerted way and even worked this into his performances, theater performances. He would divide his evening performances into three parts: one part magic, one part escapes, and one part debunking spiritualism and seances. And this is he did this in part because he believed that spiritualism was wrong, and in part because spiritualism was having a huge revival at this time after World War I, and there was a great deal of demand for people who wanted to be put in touch with their departed loved ones. And he saw an opportunity to promote himself by attacking spiritualism, because, as we've said earlier, Houdini never neglected an opportunity to promote himself.
Thanks again for the call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Adam Begley, author of the new book, Houdini, The Elusive American. Adam, you introduced me to a couple of chapters of Harry Houdini's life that I had no idea about, including Harry Houdini, aspiring pilot. How did he get into buying and flying planes?
It's a very strange episode in his life. It begins in 1910 when it was right after the first person ever crossed the English Channel in an airplane, and that sort of sparked a mania for airplane flying, and especially in Europe, which is where he was at the time. And he bought himself something called a Voisin biplane, which was this very rickety machine. It was already out of date, obsolete when he bought it. It was basically made of wire and paper. And he flew it once or twice in Germany and then was going on a tour of Australia. And so he packed up his airplane, put it on the boat, hired a guy to an engineer to take care of it, went to Australia because he thought he would become the first person ever to fly in Australia, which he did become. And he spent 5 months there basically doing his show and then afterwards going out and preparing for a flight in the morning in this biplane. And it wasn't much of an airplane. I mean, it would get up to maybe 100 feet, and he would fly for 7 or 8 minutes, and he'd come down again very bumpy. But it was the first manned flight in Australia. Houdini always wanted to be first, and this was a way in which he could be first.
I want to ask about the subtitle of your book, a very big double meaning in it, Houdini, The Elusive American. What do you mean by that?
Well, it comes from a screenplay that he himself wrote. He titled it the Adventures of Houdini, the Elusive American, and so I sort of borrowed his title. To me, it was a bit ironic. One, the elusiveness is partly the fact that he had this slippery relationship with the truth that we mentioned earlier. And then the American part is his extreme desire to be an American and his very American life, which is to be an immigrant, to come here, to work extraordinarily hard and achieve huge success. He is a great classical American success story. And then the elusive thing, finally, you know, there are parts of every person, even somebody you've written a book about, that you don't know. And so for me, it's a tip of the hat to the fact that some things about Houdini I'll never understand.
Let's bring on one more caller. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hello.
Hi. There's a lot said about his relationship with his mother, and of course he felt her. But I haven't seen much about his relationship with his father, and I'm guessing there's a lot of hostility. Can you tell me anything more about that?
Sure. I don't know if there is hostility. I think his father, I think there was a sort of absence, and I think that there was a disappointment with his father, that his father, who had been a kind of distinguished man, a learned man, couldn't adjust to America. His name is Samuel Mayer Weiss. He was, I believe, a gentleman. You know, it's hard to know from this distance exactly what he was like, but Houdini never had anything bad to say about him. And also, Houdini credited his father with having given him a love of books and learning. And Houdini went on to become a huge collector of books and of magic paraphernalia and of theater paraphernalia. He gave thousands and thousands of items to the Library of Congress when he died, for example. And so I think that his relationship with his father wasn't nearly as close as his relationship with his mother. But I wouldn't say that there was antagonism. I'd say that there was disappointment.
And briefly, Adam, there's been a lot of legend about Harry Houdini's cause of death. Probably don't have time to tell the whole story, but why has that continued to fascinate people for so long, just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Well, the fact is that Harry Houdini died after being punched in the stomach. And so a lot of people have jumped to the conclusion that he died because he was punched in the stomach. But in fact, he died of peritonitis, which comes from a burst appendix. And a burst appendix comes from a bacterial infection, not from trauma. The twist in all this is whether you believe that the spiritualists whom he was attacking were somehow behind the punch in the stomach. And if you believe that, then you might believe that that's what killed him. But I think it was bacteria.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to author Adam Begley. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Houdini, the Elusive American. Covers the career of escape artist Harry Houdini from his birth in Hungary, his childhood here in Wisconsin, and his rise to stardom.